Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below.
Okay, so welcome to the main stage of the conference tonight or today, wherever you are. We have a treat, David Abram, who was one of the highlights of the 2018 conference, cultural ecologist, geophilosopher, had to Google that one, author of Spell of the Sensuous, read that years ago, very good book, and Becoming Animal, which we're all becoming the animal at this conference, so that sounds good. David, I'm going to shut up and leave you to it. If you need me, I'll be here in the background. Over to you, sir.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. Hey, everybody, all you big-hearted humans slowly becoming more embodied. Let's see. I heard my phone go off. Let me make sure it's turned off. Oh, gadzooks. I don't know where it is. Hello to all you pensive and exuberant creatures, all you bodacious bodies, wriggling and lanky-limbed, two-legged critters. I'm speaking to you from the upper Rio Grande Valley here in northern New Mexico, from the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, homeland of the Tewa, Tiwa, and Toa-speaking peoples who live in the many pueblos that are scattered across this broad valley. And today we are under a ringing blue sky. It's about 4 or 5 days since the mountains across the valley began to show themselves again, because for several weeks, the intense azure blue of our high desert skies was obscured by the smoky haze that had blown some 2,000 or 1,500 miles from the wildfires along the West Coast, turning our late afternoon sun blood red. But so here in the high desert, we were inhaling the ghosts of trees suddenly cindered, breathing in the ashen remains of pines and spruces and redwoods and firs and oaks, inhaling whole forests that grew 1,000 miles and more from here. And as their spirits entered into us, we could taste this acrid, harsh flavor in the back of our throats. As these trees entered our lungs and our bloodstream, and circulated through our limbs, a smoky sting in the eyes as their cindered ghosts slid into the neural network behind our brows, altering our thoughts, our sensations, our actions too, because we're made of those trees now. And of course, it's not just the trees, but the countless critters who haunted those woodlands, deer and sage grouse and bears and porcupines with their quills singed off, and many creatures already on the cusp of vanishing from our world, like pine martens and spotted owl families, all going up in smoke. All these numberless shapes of sensitivity and sentience, these ghosts entering into us as we breathed, and so they were becoming human, as we are now becoming porcupine and spotted owl. It's painful, sure, but at the same time, a lot of those woodlands thrive on fire. They replenish and regenerate through fire, but it's damned uncanny when so many forests go up at once. Here at this distance, it seemed as if the whole of the West was entering into sacred time, because it's as if the land, this whole land, was being smudged, ritually smudged with sage and cedar and forest incense, as if all the West was entering into sacred space. Here's a poem by Rainer Maria Rilke. He says, "Dear darkening ground, you've endured so patiently the walls we've built. Perhaps you'll grant the cities one more hour, and the churches and synagogues too. And those who labor, will you let their work grip them another 5 hours or seven before you become forest again and ocean and widening wilderness in that hour of unspeakable terror when you take back your name from all things? Just grant me a little more time. I want to love the things as no one has thought to love them, until they are worthy of you and real." That's Rilke. But so, hey, I'm David. I'm a cultural ecologist, which kind of combines anthropology and ecology. I'm a philosopher, or what some folks call a geophilosopher, which just means somebody who is learning to think, to reflect under the influence of a more than human earth. But my particular fascination as an ecologist has to do, well, first and foremost, with what we could call the ecology of perception, or the ecology of sensory experience, the way the activity of our senses, of our eyes, of our skin, of our ears, of our nostrils, functions to bind our separate nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem. Yeah, as if sensory, there's the phone. It's just behind the screen. Turn it off. There we are. And throw it into the next room. So, as if sensory perception is like a silken thread that binds our individual nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem. But I'm just as engaged and fascinated with what we might call the ecology of language, how what we say has such a powerful influence on what we see or hear or even taste of the earth around us. Because I'm convinced that there are ways of speaking that many of us have inherited from this goofy civilization, ways of speaking that function to frustrate or stifle the instinctive rapport between our animal body and the animate earth around us. But I'm just as convinced that there are other ways of speaking that can actually enhance and encourage that spontaneous reciprocity between our animal senses and the earthly sensuous. So that's what I'm on about. It seems to me that humans are tuned for relationship. The eyes, the skin, the tongue, the ears and nostrils, all of these, I think, are gates where our body receives the nourishment of otherness. This landscape of shadowed voices, these feathered bodies and antlers and tumbling streams, all these breathing shapes are our family. They're the beings with whom we're engaged, with whom we struggle and suffer and celebrate. For the largest part of our species' existence, humans negotiated relationships with every aspect of the sensuous surroundings, exchanging possibilities with every flapping form, with each textured surface and shivering entity that we happened to look at or focus upon. All could speak, articulating in gesture and whistle and sigh, a shifting web of meanings that we felt on our skin, or inhaled through our nostrils, or focused with our listening ears, and to which we replied as well, whether with sounds or through movements or minute shifts of mood, the color of sky, the rush of waves, every aspect of the earthly sensuous could draw us into a relationship fed with curiosity and spiced with danger. Every sound was a voice. Every scrape or blunder was a meeting with thunder, with oak tree, with dragonfly. And from all of these relationships, our collective sensibilities were nourished. But today, we participate almost exclusively with other two-leggeds and with our own human-made technologies. It's a precarious situation, I think, given our age-old reciprocity with the many-voiced landscape. We still need that which is other than ourselves and our own creations. Because we're human, it seems to me, we're human only in contact and conviviality with what is not human. Now, would this imply that we have to renounce all our complex technologies? Not at all. It does imply, though, that we have to renew our acquaintance with the sensuous world in which our techniques and our technologies are all rooted, without the oxygenating breath of the forests, without the clutch of gravity and the tumbled magic of river rapids. We have no distance from our technologies, no way of assessing their limitations, no way to keep ourselves from turning into those technologies. We need to know the textures, the rhythms, and tastes of the body's world, and to distinguish readily between those tastes and those of our own invention. Direct, sensuous reality, in all its more than human mystery, remains the sole solid touchstone for an experiential world now inundated with electronically generated vistas and engineered pleasures, only in regular contact with the tangible ground and sky can we learn how to orient and to navigate in the multiple dimensions that now claim us.
So
what I'm saying is trust your senses. Open and awaken your animal senses. Step out into this wild and shadowed wonder of a world. And yeah, trust these creaturely senses. We've been taught that we shouldn't trust them, that the senses are deceptive, that they lie to us. We have to find out the real truth of things from the experts. Yeah, we're now so accustomed to this notion of expertise, that the very notion of honoring and paying heed to our directly felt experience of things, of insects and wooden floors and broken down cars and bird-pecked apples and the scents rising from the soil, it all seems kind of odd and sort of misguided as a way to find out what's worth knowing. According to assumptions long held by the civilization in which I was raised, the deepest truth of things is always concealed behind the appearances in dimensions inaccessible to my bodily senses. So 1,000 years ago, these dimensions were viewed in spiritual terms. The sensuous world was a fallen world. It was a derivative reality that could only be understood by reference to heavenly realms hidden behind the stars, right? Since the powers residing in those realms were concealed from common experience, they had to be mediated for the general populace, for us, by priests who might intercede with those celestial agencies on our behalf. In recent centuries, an abundance of discoveries and inventions have completely transformed our culture's general conception of things, but the basic disparagement of sensuous reality still remains. It's like an old collective habit, very difficult to kick. The directly sensed world is still explained by reference to realms hidden beyond our direct experience. Such a realm, for example, is the microscopic domain of axons and dendrites and neurotransmitters washing across neuronal synapses, a dimension entirely concealed from direct experience. And yet it presumably precipitates or gives rise to every aspect of our experience. Another such dimension is the recondite realm hidden in the nuclei of our cells, wherein reside the intricately folding strands of DNA and RNA that ostensibly code and perhaps even cause the behavior of living things. Or alternatively, the deepest source and truth of the apparent world is sometimes held to exist in the subatomic realm of quarks and mesons and gluons, or in a still more theoretical realm of vibrating 10-dimensional strings. Or maybe it's in the initial breaking of symmetries in the cosmological Big Bang, an event almost inconceivably distant in time and space. Every one of these arcane dimensions radically transcends the reach of our unaided senses. And since we have no ordinary experience of those realms, the essential truths to be found there have to be mediated for us by experts, by those who have access to the high-powered instruments and the inordinately expensive technologies, electron microscopes, functional MRI scanners, radio telescopes, super colliders, that might offer them a momentary glimpse into those dimensions. So here, just like before, the sensuous world, I mean the creaturely world directly encountered by our animal senses, is commonly assumed to be a secondary and derivative reality understood only by reference to more primary realms that exist somewhere else behind the scenes. So listen, I do not deny the importance of those other scales or dimensions, nor the value of the truths that might be found there. I deny only that this shadowed earthly world of deer tracks and moss is somehow less worthy, less real than those abstract dimensions. It's more palpable to my skin, more substantial to my flaring nostrils, more precious, infinitely more precious to the heart drumming within my chest. This directly experienced terrain, rippling with cricket rhythms and scoured by the tides, is the very realm now most ravaged by the spreading consequences of our disregard. Many long-standing and lousy habits have enabled our callous treatment of surrounding nature, empowering us to clear-cut, dam up, mine, develop, poison, or simply destroy so much of what quietly sustains us. But few are as deep-rooted and damaging as the habitual tendency to view the sensuous earth as a subordinate space, whether as a sinful plane riddled with temptation, needing to be transcended and left behind, or a menacing region needing to be beaten and bent to our will, or simply a vaguely disturbing dimension to be avoided, superseded, and explained away. After all, bodily life is plenty difficult. To identify with the sheer physicality of one's flesh may well seem lunatic. This body is an imperfect and breakable entity, vulnerable to 1,001 insults, to scars and the scorn of others, to disease, decay, and death. And the material world that our body inhabits is hardly a gentle place. The shuddering beauty of this biosphere is bristling with thorns. I mean, generosity and abundance often seem scant ingredients compared with the prevalence of predation, sudden pain, and racking loss. Illness, COVID-19. I mean, carnally embedded as we are in the depths of this cacophonous profusion of earthly forms, we commonly can't even predict just what's lurking behind the near boulder, let alone get enough distance to fathom and figure out all the workings of this world. We simply cannot get it under control. We've lost hearing in one ear. The other rings like a fallen spoon. Our spouse falls in love with someone else, while our young kid comes down with a bone-rattling fever that no doctor seems able to diagnose. There are things out and about that can eat us, and ultimately will. Small wonder, then, that we prefer to abstract ourselves whenever we can, imagining ourselves into theoretical spaces less fraught with insecurity, conjuring dimensions more open to calculation and control. We slip blissfully into machine-mediated scapes, offering ourselves up to any technology that promises to enhance the humdrum capacities of our given flesh. And sure, now and then, we'll engage this earthen world as well, as long as we know it's not ultimate, as long as we're convinced that we're not stuck here. It's weird, even among ecologists and environmental activists, there's this tacit sense that we better not let our awareness come too close to our animal sensations, that we better keep our arguments girded with statistics and our thoughts buttressed with abstractions, lest we succumb to an overwhelming grief, a heartache born of our organism's instinctive empathy with the living land and its cascading losses, lest we be bowled over and broken by our dismay at the relentless devastation of the biosphere. And so we shelter ourselves from the harrowing vulnerability of bodied existence. But by the same gesture, we also insulate ourselves from the deepest wellsprings of joy. We cut our lives off from the necessary nourishment of contact and interchange with other shapes of life, from antlered and loop-tailed and amber-eyed beings whose resplendent weirdness loosens our imaginations, from the droning of bees and the gurgling night chorus of the frogs and the morning mist rising like a crowd of ghosts off the weed lot. We seal ourselves off from the erotic warmth of a cello's voice or from the tilting dance of construction cranes against a downtown sky overbursting with blue, or from the errant hummingbird pulsing in our cupped hands as we ferry it back out the door, and the crimson flash as it zooms from our fingers. For way too long, we've closed ourselves to the participatory life of our senses, inured ourselves from the felt intelligence of our muscled flesh and its many solidarities. We've taken our primary truths from technologies that hold the world at a distance. Such tools can be plenty useful, obviously, and beneficial too, as long as the insights they yield are carried carefully back to the lived world and placed in service to the more than human matrix of corporeal encounter and experience. But technology can also, and very easily, be used as a way to avoid direct encounter, as a kind of shield etched with lines of code and cryptic jargon to ward off whatever frightens, as a synthetic heaven or haven in which to hide out from the distressing ambiguity of the real. Only by welcoming uncertainty from the get-go can we acclimate ourselves to the shattering wonder that enfolds us. This animal body, for all its susceptibility and vertigo, remains the primary instrument of all our knowing, as the capricious earth remains our primary cosmos. So, yeah. I hope that makes some kind of loopy sense. And I want to say a little bit now also about language. I mean, about the ecology of language, how we speak, because it's not enough it seems to me, to just feel into and settle into your bodily presence, into my bodily felt presence. Because in this over-civilized moment, we've inherited so many ways of speaking that keep splitting our minds off from the rest of our animal body, and hence from the animate earth. What I want to say is that the body is our access to the world. This body situates us in the world as a thing among things. By virtue of my body, I am a piece of the world. I'm able to see things only because I myself am visible. I'm able to hear the sounds of the world because I am a sonorous sounding being myself. And I can touch things only because I've got my own tactile textures, my smoothnesses, and my rough edges. Similarly, why is it that we're able to smell the many whiffs and scents that the wind carries? Well, obviously, it's because we give off our own odors, our rich scents, like the perfume of our sweat. Just ask any mosquito that's hovering around. And we can taste and savor the tastes of the world, lettuce leaves and ripe tomatoes and the crust of a fresh pizza bubbling, you know, because we've got our own tastes, our delectable flavors, our strange aftertastes. Ask that same mosquito. We can sense the world around us only because we're entirely a part of this world, because by virtue of our own carnal density and dynamism, we are wholly embedded in the depths of the earthly sensuous. We can feel the tangible textures, the sounds and shapes of the biosphere, because we are tangible, resonant, audible shapes in our own right. Perception is this reciprocity. I touch the smooth bark of a madrone tree, and I feel the tree touching me in the same gesture. We are born of these very waters, this very air, this loamy soil, this sunlight. Nourished and sustained by the substance of this breathing earth, we are flesh of its flesh. We are not pure spirits nor pure minds, but our sensitive and sentient bodies, able to be seen, heard, tasted, and touched by the beings around us. So this body has this uncanny capacity to empathize with other bodies, to enter into a reverberation with any other flesh in order to feel something of what that other feels. Not totally, never totally, but still the soft animal of my body can feel into and empathize with and mimetically enter into relation with any other animal. It can pick up a reverberation from a plant. Any plant, actually, a clump of sagebrush, an oak tree, any stone even, or a dry riverbed, or a gust of wind, if we allow it to. I mean, the body is our very capacity for metamorphosis, for shape-shifting. But the ways that we think and speak massively inhibit this participation with everything around. Our entanglement with earthworms, blackbirds, wolves, our interbeing with forests and wetlands and glacier-fed rivers has long been hidden by ways of speaking that define the rest of nature as a set of inanimate, passive objects and objective mechanical processes, or as a stock of passive, inert resources simply waiting to be used by us. But let's face it, it's difficult, if not impossible, to feel compassion for an inert or inanimate object. It's difficult to feel empathy for a machine or for anything we look upon as just a set of mechanisms. Difficult to feel compassion for a clutch of purely mechanical or programmed processes. And so fresh forms of articulation are called for in this moment, ways of speaking and thinking that can unleash our instinctive somatic empathy and compassion for other species being pushed to the brink of extinction, for the lakes and rivers now dwindling and drying up as the glaciers that feed them continue to melt and disappear. Compassion for the herbs and forests trying to survive in these drought-stricken valleys, like this one out my window. Or for the soils and the dammed up rivers and the broad oceans of this planet, these currents laced with crude and strewn with bright colored plastic. So I think we should take a clue here from our indigenous ancestors and from our indigenous brothers and sisters still thriving on the land today. Whether we speak of the Pueblo cultures here where I live, or the Hopi who live just beyond the horizon, or the Koyukon people of Central Alaska, or the Cree and the Lakota of the plains, or the Kayapo and the Warani folks of the Amazon basin, or the Sami of Northern Scandinavia, or the Ogoni people of Nigeria, or the Pintubi and Pijantjara in Central Australia. All of these cultures are so outrageously diverse. I mean, they're so bizarrely different from one another in their life ways, in their rituals, and their cosmologies. Often it's hard to believe that they can possibly exist on the same planet. And yet they share a few elements in common, such as the fact that all these indigenous place-based peoples seem to assume that everything is alive, that everything has agency. That is, they refuse any sharp, hard and fast distinction between that which is animate and that which is inanimate. Rather, for them, everything is animate. Everything moves. It's just that some things move a lot slower than other things, like the ground underfoot or the walls of this house. And yet they still move. Everything has its dynamism, its pulse. For these peoples, everything is alive, awake, even aware, not just humans and other animals and plants, of course, but also, yeah, whole forests are alive and hold a kind of wakeful intelligence, and mountains, rivers too, are alive and aware, even dry riverbeds, caves, cliff faces, winds, and the weather powers. Anything that we can experience or sense with our bodily senses is assumed to be a sensitive and perhaps even sentient being in its own right. And I think that suggests, since it's common to so many outrageously divergent cultures, it suggests that this intuition that everything is alive, that nothing is fixed and finished and closed up in itself, but that each thing has its own pulse, its own interior animation, its own agency, its own way or style of dancing into the present moment. It suggests that this intuition is not just really old in us, but that it is our most basic, most ordinary human way of experiencing the world. That in the absence of intervening technologies, anything we can sense is assumed to be sensitive in its own right, able to feel and even respond to the things around it, and perhaps to us. It's also an exceedingly practical way of speaking, because let's face it, it's hard to feel into and suss out the changing mood of the sky if you don't believe that the sky has moods. It's really hard to enter into a wordless conversation with a lichen-encrusted boulder if you don't trust that boulder has its own activity or agency. Or to dialogue with a spider if you think it's just a set of mechanical programs. It's tough to slip into an improvisational dance, a duet with a maple tree or an oak tree, if you don't trust that that tree has its own sensations and feelings, although they're sensations that are very different from your own. Different, yeah. I mean, actually, that's really important to say. To assume that everything is alive or that everything is animate is not to say that everything is the same or that it's all one or some fairly boring notion like that. No, it's the opposite. It's a way of opening up to the outrageous differences between things, a way of exploring the multiplicity of things, the irreducible pluralism of our world. If everything is alive, then I can, you know, walk up to a slab of granite and inquire, what is your way of being, your style of presencing into the present moment? And how is that different from this chunk of sandstone here? What's your way, your style of life? So, again, let me know. I mean, is this making some kind of sense? Indicate with a hand or, okay. At least for some of you folks. Language. Let me give a couple other examples of the way our ways of speaking can so alter the way we feel. Well, I mean, a simple way of speaking you could try on, simple enough that any child can understand it, is that which recognizes the immensity of this earth as our larger flesh, as our actual body, a huge spherical metabolism in which these smaller bodies are embedded. Because truly, aren't we one body with the mountains and the woodlands and the soils being depleted by our insane industrial agriculture? Are we not one body with the roiling ocean currents, echoing with faint glissandos of whale song, but also now infused by toxins leaking from our power plants? How easy it is to overlook such careless accidents and oil spills if we think of the earth and its ecosystems in mechanical terms. But really, are not these rivers our own bloodstream? Are not these granite cliffs our own bones? Are not the leafing forests the green lungs of our larger body, of this wider, more than human life in which our separate lives are entwined? I'm sure many of you folks have thought of this and are already practicing this, but for the others, try this out. See if it makes sense that this two-legged, two-armed form is your smaller body and the vast earth is your larger body, or rather our larger body, a huge spherical metabolism or flesh that we share in common with one another and with the pine trees and the lynx and the Arctic fox. Our smaller physiologies are utterly embedded and entangled within our larger flesh. Relative to our individual lifespans, the round biosphere, if we don't wreck it, is a kind of eternity out of which we're all born and into which we all return, recycling ourselves, reincarnating as earthworms and aspen groves and migrating geese, as sea lions and mangrove swamps, this wild planet, our eternal body, whirling silent among the stars. One other example. But first, let's just move for a moment. A simple 1 minute exercise I want to offer in is just see if you can feel the air around you as a thick, palpable, meaning-filled plenum. And see if you can move whether your arms or your whole body as if you are carving within this medium. Without tearing it, without harming it, but just carve your limbs within this thick medium of air. Actually, try feeling yourself as a stalk of seaweed at the bottom of the ocean, and just feel the currents moving through and around you. And let it stretch your muscles as you do so. That's grand. That's grand. Because I want to offer up this one other example. This odd thing in our common conventional ways of speaking, we talk about living on the earth, and even here in the States, one of our main environmental radio programs is called Living on Earth. But we also speak of being placed on earth for this or that purpose. Or we say, on the face of the earth, this is happening, or that is happening. In ever so many ways, we talk about living on the earth. But it seems to me that this is a goof. Because, I don't know, if you're outside, no, most of you look like you're indoors. But if you were to look up at the clouds, if there were clouds, we've got a few in the blue outside my window. It's interesting, those clouds are way up there. And we know that the earth is spinning like a dervish around its axis, spinning toward the east incredibly fast, like, you know, a couple thousand miles an hour near the equator. Here it's maybe more, just like 1,000 miles an hour. That's fast. So shouldn't I see those clouds just whipping off toward the west, since the whole planet is spinning so rapidly beneath them? And yet we don't see those clouds hurtling off toward the west. In fact, the clouds I see out my window are just kind of lollygagging up there, or drifting a bit toward the south at this moment. Why is that? And when I ask among, you know, my students or folks I'm working with, I say, well, how come those clouds are not all charging off toward the west? Some perspicacious student pipes up and says, because those clouds are accompanying the earth as it turns, which of course is true, because they are held by the air, and because those clouds are earth up there, because that's earth, because the air, which is entirely a part of the earth, stretches up many, many miles far above those clouds, because the air, I mean, we are immersed in this atmosphere as thoroughly as fish are immersed in the sea. And yet we say we live on the earth, but no, we don't live on the earth. We live in the earth. We live down here in the depths of this breathing planet. Not on, but in the earth, or rather in the earth, the earth. I want to suggest that we spell our planet once in a while in a slightly different way, that we put an I in the middle of the word and spell it E-A-I-R-T-H, an I, because I want to say that the I, which is also the letter we use for ourself, for me, I, that upright slash or vertical line, is actually a kind of pictogram of the spine of this animal. I don't know, maybe I can show you this. We are this curious primate that for so long was walking around on all fours. And at a certain point now and then. We would balance on our hind legs to look around and then back on all fours. But then at one moment, we got skilled enough balancing here that we started actually walking around on our hind legs. And that moment, that shift to the vertical, whoa. I mean, that was a big, big change for our lineage, yes? At which point all the trees around us became our closest allies in verticality. But I'm wanting to say that the eye, that vertical slash, can be seen as a pictogram of the upright spine of the human animal. And if we take that letter I, that upright letter, and place it in the middle of the name of our planet, Earth, it becomes Earth, in order to say that the I, the self, am embedded in the air. I am immersed in air, A-I-R. And the air is entirely a part of the Earth, E-A-I-R-T-H, the Earth, which sounds a bit Scottish, which is also useful. So,
Few questions here. If you're interested, we've got about 9 minutes left. Do you want me to? If you want me to read out some, let me know.
Sure. Yeah, hit me with a question.
It's just difficult to step into such beautiful poetic talk. There's one from Stephen here. What practices do you recommend to include the other than human sense of reality? And his follow-up question is, how do we not privilege the human sense of reality?
There's about 10,005 answers to that. But maybe the one I'll offer up is just linked to what I was saying a moment ago. To notice that there wouldn't be any air here if not for all the green and rooted, leafing and needled beings around my house, around your home, around the town or city where you live. It's a trippy thing, but the photosynthetic metabolism of all these plants entails that they give off or breathe out oxygen, which is this very nifty element that we humans, but also all the other animals along with us, need to breathe in for our respiratory metabolism. So we inhale some of this invisible stuff and we circulate it through our limbs and alchemize it within our lungs, and then we breathe it out. And as we breathe it out, it's now altered, transformed, infused with carbon dioxide, which is the very wild ingredient that all of those rooted plants need to breathe in for their photosynthetic metabolism. So what the trees breathe out, all us animals breathe in. And what the animals breathe out, all the trees are breathing in. I mean, talk about reciprocity. It's, for me, that is an astonishment. And it turns out that the air or the atmosphere of this planet, it's not just a bunch of gases held down to the Earth's surface by gravity. No, it is born of, generated by all of us animals and plants interbreathing with one another. All of us interbreathing with each other and with the soils and with the oceans. The air is this outrageous elixir born of our interbeing. Yes, a gorgeous word coined by Thich Nhat Hanh, great, wonderful monk, Vietnamese monk, and used by many of us now as an indispensable term, interbeing. But I want to add to it interbreathing, which is also a word also seeded and sparked up by a great rabbi named Arthur Wasco, the interbreathing of us with all these other beings. So to notice whenever you're breathing, whenever you are also dropping into your body and coming to your breath, to notice that you're breathing with all the plants that surround. That the air or the breath is not, it's not just a way of coming close to your body, it's a way of noticing your body's utter entanglement with all these other bodies. So that's one small but useful notion, interbreathing.
David, there's another simple one here from Julia saying, what are some of your favorite reading recommendations that can help facilitate our connection with the natural world? Maybe Steve could type them in if you, there's a few books you want to recommend, The Spell of the Sensuous being an obvious one, I'll say, so you don't have to.
Yeah, or my later book, Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology. But gadzooks, there's so much good stuff out there. My friend Richard Powers' recent novel, The Overstory, that's one I'd recommend. A beautiful one. Or Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. The poetry of Gary Snyder or Wendell Berry, or the writings of my sister Terry Tempest Williams. There's so much one could speak of, but I'll stop there lest I start overflowing like a fountain with favorite books. A novel called Reindeer Moon by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. Two of my favorite ever novels of the 20th century. One is called The Song of the World, and the other is called Joy of Man's Desiring by the French novelist Jean Giono. Okay.
Wonderful. Some good ones there. And maybe we'll start a Facebook thread in the group around this sort of books on this kind of work, because often people add great stuff and it's easy to miss the chat. Let's see, we could squeeze in this one. Maya Ward says thanks for the exquisite enchantment you are creating with us. I agree with that. How might we work with our bodies to be able to better bear the intensity and subtlety of taking responsibility for the capacity to voice the presences of more than human ones? That shamanic oneness feels fraught with danger and power that requires some sturdy embodiment.
Oh,
3 minutes, easy.
Well, the way we, and hey, Maya, it's good to hear from you. I think we fortify ourselves in the very same way that we render ourselves vulnerable to all these other shapes and styles of sensitivity and sentience. That is, by falling in love outward, as the poet Robinson Jeffers called it, falling in love outward with the world. To become embodied is not just to become tuned to your own body, because the body is this relational being who is utterly interfused with all these other bodies, most of which ain't human. And I am a pretty vulnerable creature. Each of us is. I mean, these featherless bipeds that we are, we've even lost most of our fur, so we're really exposed to the real in its wonder. But by that very nature, we also have this capacity I was speaking of earlier to be informed by and pick up on or enter into a resonance with any other shape, any other body. And so I can pick up from stone and boulder something of its intense strength and reckless, you know, bodaciousness. I can pick up from a tree, whether it be an aspen or a cottonwood or a redwood, something of its flexibility and its ability to just move and flex in the wind of these storms that are now gathering big time on the horizon for every one of us, wherever we live. So I think it's by opening our hearts and our spirits to the land and beginning to find which creatures, what animals and what plants are your particular medicine, or what types of rock really feed you, or what styles of weather. Some people hate it when big rainstorms start pouring down, but others of us love the storm and rush out and just like dance naked under the pelting rain. So finding out what gives you that strength, but you've got so many medicines to draw on and to gather from. So that's a first tiny bit of an answer to that difficult question. Yeah, it's dangerous out here. It's dangerous. And I think that's why we've all, and our whole culture, has spent so much time hiding from the world in virtual spaces and ducking our embodiment. Yeah.
Okay, David, thank you. Beautifully poetic and inspiring as ever. I think people would enjoy that. And Steve will put your website up in the chat. If people want to get to your work and find out more, certainly recommend your books. Shout out to Carrie's Cats as well. Let's put them on. There we go. Carrie's Cats. Give them a bit of love. And a few other practicalities. Well, Steve will start that Facebook thread about the books. So if you want to sort of continue that, go to the Facebook group. It's actually really civilized as a Facebook group, really pleasant. So have a look at the Facebook group. If you want to do a coffee break afterwards and chat to other human beings rather than sort of make the communication two ways, the coffee break feature of the portal is a really nice feature. You must have found the portal to come here. So if you go, I think it's top right, there's three little dots and then a red coffee cup. And if you click on that afterwards, you'll be put in a room and you can chat to some other humans about your experience. As ever, if you wanna, this is free for 48 hours. You can tell your friends, you can share the Facebook of it. Charles Eisenstein's Last Night, I really recommend, is also still free. So check that out. It was really touching. Tomorrow, there's also today for some of you, Philip Shepherd, well worth catching. Lots in the ecology and research track that is worth a look there. Jamie McHugh's another one I know personally. There's some great people in there, all sorts of Aboriginal traditions, researchers, all sorts of people. So lots on. My brain is starting to shut down now, but you're welcome to that. After 48 hours, you can buy the recordings for everything, of course, as well, if you want to help us out. But also, just so you know, you don't have to feel overwhelmed, you don't have to rush, you can digest it all in your own time. The recordings are well worth getting the library. So do check that out in the upgrade link Steve has got there. We can pay our Zoom bills. So great. I don't know what else to say. I think I've covered the main practical things. I'll see you tomorrow, many of you in other places. David, final word for our sort of conference book. We're asking people for a top tip, and this is brutal, but one sentence top tip.
One sentence?
I know, asking David Abram for one sentence. Is it going to happen? What do you reckon? Take your time.
I love sentences. I can craft long ones. I would say, how about this? Forget being heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual and become omnisexual. That is, open an erotic relation with everything, with oak trees and aspen trees, mountain lions, fireflies, with the storm clouds overhead, with seaweed and waterfalls, with morel mushrooms, and with the ground underfoot. Become omnisexual.
Boom. That's how we roll. Omnisexual. Good place to end. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Steve, for staying up and being my late night partner once again. Big love to Steve for hosting, taking care of the cat things. Carrie's Cats. Definitely got a lot of love there. People can see them. Have a wonderful day or night, everyone. Big thank you once again to David for his poetry. And we'll see you in a breakout group or on Facebook, many of you. Take it easy.